All right, welcome back, everyone. You're tuned in once again to BME Radio. On the phone with us today is Eric Sprague, also known as the Lizard Man or Amago in the current Jim Rose lineup. And unless you live under a rock, you've surely witnessed Eric's rise to freak superstardom over the past 2 years. He's probably the most recognizable face in the scene right now, but there's a lot more to him than just a hissing sideshow act. You all know Eric with his surgically altered forehead, his forked tongue and spiked teeth and scaled face and arms and hands, but we're going to go back a lot earlier than that. Eric, let's start with talking about what were you like as a little kid?
I was pretty boring, actually. I think I was basic little kid. I did the whole little league baseball. Didn't like that too much. Did play a lot of soccer on through high school, but I mean, as a child, I think it was just basically pretty normal. I mean, maybe on the artsy side, I was one of the kids that, you know, was by himself drawing or painting or building things out of rocks more so than playing team sports, but nothing unusual.
Mm-hmm. Did you watch Star Trek or play Dungeons and Dragons or anything sort of?
Mm-hmm. I had my Dungeons and Dragons period, as I think a lot of people have, whether they, you know, into modification or not.
Mm-hmm.
I watched the original Star Trek series in reruns on Sunday mornings, mm-hmm. but never became, you know, enjoyed the show, but never sort of a big series fan.
Right. Am I remembering right that you were a military kid? And
Mm-hmm. Yep. My father was in the military. I was actually born on a military base, but he managed to get enough rank and position and set himself up to where we were fairly stable by the time I was about midway through elementary school. We knew we weren't moving out of town. We weren't moving out of a school district anymore, just sort of banging around within it.
Right, so you weren't, your childhood wasn't a disrupted, disjointed childhood. It was, I mean...
Oh, it was incredibly stable.
Same as, let's say, you know, most people in university.
Right, yeah, it was, you know, pretty much about like that. I think that, if anything, it became more of an advantage instead of a disadvantage. I didn't have the disjointed part. Mm-hmm. But because my father had friends and connections and such around, we did travel quite a bit. So I got a good broad base of travel, you know, early on in my childhood through, you know, anytime there was a break, okay, we're going to drive across the country to see these people here from when I was stationed there, or this relative here, or, you know, we're going to go to Canada, we're going to go to Europe, we're going to do, you know, these things just sort of worked into the schedule. So, and even when I didn't get to go along, it's one of those things where if he came back from Germany, you know, there's a week that as a kid I learned about German culture because he'd be telling me about his trip over there. Mm-hmm. And also being a teacher, he sort of, you know, did that intentionally. Both my parents were working in education as well.
Right. And at what point, was it high school when your more obvious eccentricity started showing up?
I think that's when they sort of started to develop there. I mean, you can take any of the things that, you know, any child does and you say, how are they going to develop, you know, drawing and stuff can end up being just simply painting or whatever. For myself, it became, I was doing more and more stuff where I wanted to paint my body, elaborate costumes. I was writing short skit, like theater pieces for, you know, the theater clubs and stuff to do, or for variety shows. And those became either very straight satirical pieces on sort of local news and culture, or they were sort of very odd and esoteric sort of stuff, and those really didn't get done that much because, you know, in high school, when you get to find enough people that can that will take the risk of looking like complete idiots out in front of a bunch of people.
Yeah, I guess you have it now with Marilyn Manson kids.
Yeah, and now we have an overabundance of people who just don't care what people think at an early age.
Mm-hmm. But how was your social life fairly normal?
Very normal. I mean, it was a rural public high school that I did junior high and high school mm-hmm. in. And, I mean, I played varsity sports. I was active in a lot of clubs. I was, at that point, was sort of my leanings of my apolitical anarchist sort of bent. So I stayed away from stuff like that, except for when I could turn it to my own advantage.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I was an honor student and did pretty much the typical sort of things. I mean, I was offered sort of, you know, going out of high school, I think, it's indicative of what I was offered in terms of college options. At the end, military academies were sort of courting me. I wasn't a good enough athlete to get sort of scholarships, but it was definitely there. as an activity. I was, in no way really, an outcast or anything. I was definitely recognized within my peer groups as being sort of the weird guy, but I was, an accepted weird guy.
Right.
They're like, oh, he's just having one of those days, or he's off on a tangent. Mm-hmm. It's no
big deal. The reason I was asking is I just wanted to illustrate to everyone that you weren't, weren't this weird geeky kid that everyone beat up on, and this, turned you into a monster.
Hey, one of my best friends in the world right now works for the state police in New York. So I mean, there you go. We had essentially the same upbringing. I mean, I call his parents mom and dad. He calls mine mom and dad. There is no real difference in our upbringing, except he ended up being a cop and I ended up being a circus freak.
And you went to university. I mean, you're not a school dropout,
right?
If it weren't for this one thing, you'd be exactly what society, I mean, mainstream society, is looking for in a young guy.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, on paper, I am. I'm the American dream on paper.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm gonna play. The first thing that we played there, that was Frosty and the Diamonds, Destination Mars, off of the sort of beat jazz German reissue on Pesky Serpent Records. I'm going to play one other track from that. It's Bob Doro doing Dog. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Eric about the animal symbolism and what made him decide to take the lizard route instead of something analogous to the puzzle route that Enigma took.
The dog trots freely in the street and sees reality, and the things he sees are bigger than himself, and the things he sees are his reality. Drunks in doorways, moons on trees. The dog trots freely through the street, and the things he sees are smaller than himself. Fish on newsprint, ants in holes, chickens in Chinatown windows, their heads a block away. The dog trots freely in the street, and the things he smells something like himself. The dog trots freely in the street past puddles and babies, cats and cigars, pool rooms and policemen. He doesn't hate cops, he merely has no use for them. And he goes past them, past the dead cows hung up whole in front of the San Francisco meat market. He would rather eat a tender cow than a tough policeman, though either might do. He goes past the Romeo Ravioli Factory, past Cott's Tower, past Congressman Doyle. He's afraid of Cott's Tower, but he's not afraid of Congressman Doyle, although what he hears is very discouraging, very depressing, very absurd. To a sad young dog like himself, to a serious dog like himself. But he has his own free world to live in, his own fleas to eat. He will not be muzzled. Congressman Doyle is just another fire hydrant to him. The dog trots freely in the street and has his own dog's life to live and to think about and to reflect upon, touching and tasting and testing everything, investigating everything without benefit of perjury. A real realist with a real tale to tell. And a real tale to tell it with. A real live, barking, democratic dog engaged in real free enterprise with something to say about ontology, something to say about reality, and how to see it, and how to hear it, with his head cocked sideways at street corners as if he is just about to have his picture taken for Victor Records. Listening for his master's voice and looking like a living question mark into the great gramophone of puzzling existence with its wondrous hollow horn, which always seems just about to spout forth some victorious answer to everything.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're back with Eric. Hopefully Eric can hear us. We're sort of experimenting with this board right now. It's the first time we've patched in music.
Yep, I can hear you fine.
Excellent, excellent. Eric's back. Now, we were talking before about your choice of transformation. What made you decide on an animal transformation and more specifically a reptile transformation?
Right. Well, the first thing that I sort of got into when I started thinking about the transformation as a project sort of conceptually was, you know, what would it take to sort of do this break off, you know, sort of a visual break that's there. And really there's just sort of, you know, different motifs that come to mind. And I knew it wasn't going to be sort of, you know, the traditional bodysuit, say, whether it be, you know, Japanese style. It wasn't going to be imagery of that sort. And I've always been a large fan of, you know, large abstract black work patterns and things like this. And sideshow history wise, Omi, of course, is someone that very early on I kind of latched onto and was very, you know, impressed and intrigued by. So as I sort of started working, I was working with the sort of large black abstract shapes that you can see on, like, my torso and my back, and actually now in bands around my upper thighs and various places. And then sort of looking at the negative space, I was going to keep filling that in and work with it. It wasn't so much a choice of an animal motif and then what animal. It was more the reptilian motif sort of came to mind. I was thinking about basically my hands and my feet, and at one point just thinking about growing them out of the black work. And that kind of evolved into thinking, well, why not run it all the way through and do this sort of, you know, tattooed lizard man sort of thing. A lot of the background images that I'm working with sort of in my head, especially sort of, you know, childhood influences and things like that, are characters like the lizard from Spider-Man comics. I was an avid comic book reader for a while. I still love comic art, you know, to an extent. And, you know, that was just one kind of push. And there were other elements that are there. I mean, reptiles tend to be my favorite animals. You know, so, you know, people who like bears get tattoos of bears. Well, instead of getting a tattoo of a lizard, I'm getting tattooed to like a lizard. So there's a lot of different things that go into it. They all sort of come together there. And ultimately, it was just a matter of my process of doing something is often, especially with tattooing, to design the image, put it out in front of myself, and make myself live with it for a certain amount of time and see, you know, how it strikes me when I look at it every day as a drawing on the wall or, you know, as a mock-up on my face with makeup or such, or even any part of my body with just, you know, a quick, you know, mock-up stencil to see how it looks. And once that I sort of reconfirm my initial feeling, yeah, this is it, then we go ahead with it. And that explains to a lot of people why, you know, I sort of started designing and thinking about this almost 10 years ago, but in the last couple of years, there's been the explosion of actual progress in the actualization of it. And you know, I've had a couple of people comment like, you know, wow, you went from, you know, not a whole lot to, you know, bang in the span of a year or two doing quite a bit of work.
Although you already had the heavy black work, it just was
right
below the neck.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, it's just what it ends up being is that these last couple of years, this burst of work getting done is just the result of all the you know, the build up to it, putting in all the groundwork beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, as a philosophy student, What's the statement do you think that you're making with the modifications that you're doing?
A lot of the ideas behind the conceptual part of it. I mean, at the bare bones basic part of it is it's just something that I want to do. I find it very self-satisfying to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
Just as I think, you know, anyone who draws or paints or writes would say, yeah, you know, I love to draw, I love to paint, I love to write. Yeah, but you also sort of parlay that in. So then, well, what about this drawing? It's got a meaning behind it. Well, with what I'm doing with my transformation, sort of the philosophy of our background and the psychological and linguistic things that are tied into it are a lot of them taken from people like Wittgenstein and, you know, pragmatic psychology views, which sort of look at reported mental states versus the mental state that would be sort of implied by one's behavior. so that I'm sort of a real-time experiment of ideas of, say, family resemblance from language theory and sort of belief states in pragmatic psychology.
Okay, well, you've probably gone over most people's heads,
right,
even with that. But you've experimented with reality quite a bit, as far as sleep deprivation and motion deprivation. What are some of the experiments you've done there and the motivations behind those?
I think the most basic motivation, I think the motivation is easier to describe than sort of the grocery list of things that I've done. The basic motivation is, you know, just the primary know thyself. I encountered things like, you know, elements of ritualistic magic and quantum psychology and self-programming and metaprogramming very early on. And a lot of times, you know, something like tail end of elementary school, junior high is where I first started running into these things. And as might be expected, I was in over my head for a while, so I had to keep coming back to elements before I was really sort of getting the point and understanding it. But one thing I sort of figured out very early on and became sort of clear to me is that there's a real advantage to knowing yourself, and one of the best ways to get to know yourself is to take yourself mentally and or physically to certain degrees of extremes, to sort of find out what your reactions are, to find out how you hold up. There's, besides building up such characteristics as just good biofeedback, it gives you sort of a baseline. One of the things that strikes me from what's a, you know, Fight Club, very popular recent movie, one of the lines in it is, you know, how can you really know yourself if you've never been in a fight? Well, that was, you know, that came out for me in sort of my traditional martial arts experience, but that goes for a lot of things. You know, if you've never really been tested, you don't know how you stand up. So in pursuit of that sort of knowledge, I've done things like prolonged sleep deprivation, disrupting sleep patterns with sort of weird, you know, rotations of alarms and only sleeping for certain short periods of time, breaking it up. I've fasted. I've tried going without water. I've done immobilization experiments. I've used different ways, whether it be running, dancing, working out, to exhaust myself as much physically as I could, sort of see where that limit went. I've done, you know, sort of pain experiments, poking, prodding, piercing myself, breath holding, all sorts of different conditioning things, often based out of, you know, culturally significant things, like whether they be yoga or whatever, but trying to do the sort of standard, you know, modern quantum psychology sort of view of it, of taking the ritual significance out and just seeing what happens with the physical element, and then doing the metaprogramming thing of feeding my own elements back in so I can find good ways to sort of, you know, create my own meditations, create my own exercises, my own rituals, so that I sort of optimize that element of my life. I mean, every person has their sort of set of rituals and whatever. It's one thing to sort of have them put on you and let them influence you more or less blindly. It's another thing to sort of take control and say, all right, there are things I want to accomplish, and I will now focus my life and adjust the rituals in it so that they synergistically augment what I'm trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Are you a lot of the things you're talking about in the past would have been activities practiced by shamans when it comes down to it.
Right.
Do you see yourself almost as a shaman in training, or...
I see myself more as just general seeker at this point. Mm-hmm. I think the connotation of shaman is, you know, also there's the element of ministering back to a community. And at this point, I think that I'm still doing more, you know, sort of seeking more, you know, to put it into that sort of that archetype, is that I haven't come back to the community from the vision quest completely yet.
Are you, since we're naming movies, are you sort of analogous to the character in Altered States right now? Are you some sort of internal researcher?
I think that's not a bad analogy. There's something along those lines. And I would say that, you know, there's an element, I do like the idea of the shaman of coming back and helping out, but I haven't quite found or figured out, and that's why I say I must still be, you know, besides the fact that I still do these experiments, I think I always will, but because I haven't quite found the role and the way in which to do it. other than, you know, doing things like, you know, contributing to things like BME and sort of, you know, when people ask me, I do try and point them along, you know, trying to make myself an available resource, but there's no actual sort of put out plan in that. I just think that, you know, there's a certain degree of responsibility after a point for a person to, you know, try and make a contribution or make themselves available.
Well, I think that you're definitely changing public opinion a great deal. Anyway, we're going to play some Negative Land. This is actually some live Negative Land. This is Christianity is Stupid.
Acceptance of immorality and disregard of all moral norms.
All right, we're back with Eric. Now, Eric recently joined the Jim Rose Circus Sideshow. Mm-hmm. His previous sort of counterpart in Jim Rose, of course, was Enigma. Enigma wrote a lot of music. You know, there was a lot more to him, but Jim Rose, you know, I don't want to badmouth the show that you're in,
right?
You know, because I think the show is a lot of fun and people really enjoy it. But mm-hmm. Enigma, I think it really spit him out. You know, it marginalized him. When people think of Enigma, they don't think, you know, they don't think composer, they don't think thinker, they think, you know, this sort of, you know,
right.
half, you know, this sort of dimwit with a big fish in his mouth. You know, mm-hmm. on the X-Files.
Right.
Are you worried that you know, spending time in that? In that light is going to marginalize a lot of the more intelligent things that you have to say?
Right. I don't think that I'm personally at risk, and I'll get to that, but I think that the first thing that to sort of address is that given, you know, sort of, and it, I mean, there's that degree of fallout, like you said, the marginalization. In a way, that's almost a credit to Enigma, because with the way that Jim sets up the show and the way that, you know, sort of the X-Files and the things that come out of it go, it's a character. You know, you are really playing a character, as opposed to, you know, for the years that I performed before, I was always kind of myself up there being a freak. When Enigma was up there, when Paul was up there doing it, he is the Enigma as a character, and he, you know, so convincingly sold that within the context that people really took that for who and what he was. And there's, of course, there's a blurring of a line. It's not straight theater the way it is, so people kind of get confused about whether or not it's supposed to be a character or otherwise. And part of the reason I think that, too, that he got marginalized and why I don't think I'm at quite as much of a risk is because people don't have any real experience of him outside of the Jim Rose experience, except for what he's been able to do since then. And, of course, he's been at that slight disadvantage, like we say, because people expect, you know, the big loping monster eating the fish from the X-Files.
Yeah, I think with his current show, I'm not sure if you've seen it, but it's a real, it's a weird vaudeville sort of show.
Yeah, big departure from.
It's very different than what he did in the past, and I think that he's probably fighting to, you know, move away from that image that,
right.
that he developed.
Yeah, and the problem there being that, you know, people who are going to show up initially are going to be Jim, you know, fans of him from the Jim Rose days, and they're showing up, you know, to see a big blue monster, you know, swallow a sword, and when they start hearing the song and the dance, they might be a little bit confused. But I think ultimately that, you know, given, you know, just, you know, who he is and what he's done already, that he will be able to step over that. Myself, I have a fair amount of exposure otherwise, and I know that, you know, just given what the Jim Rose machine is, that, you know, that's going to become the most common exposure for people to me. But anything sort of beyond a cursory look will reveal pieces like, say, this interview or
Ripley's
Believe It or Not stuff, or, you know, sort of my history. And I continue to do other things like working with TSD and stuff like that. So while I actually really like the direction that we're taking sort of the character, you know, the Imago, the Lizard Man in the Jim Rose Circus, and, you know, starting to branch it out. There was a big similarity between what Enigma was for the Jim Rose Circus show and what I am now, and it's starting, you know, to branch more. It's just the fact that we've got to get over the public perception of people that, you know, a tattooed sword swallower, bug-eater or whatever, of all the similarities that there are, they can be different. And this next time that we go out in the fall is really, I think, from what we're talking about now, going to show the difference between who we are and what we do, and will also sort of give people, I think, another insight into what I was if they've only sort of seen my last time out with Jim.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm gonna branch over onto something different.
Mm-hmm.
Your ego is probably already big enough from everything that's happened lately, but if I can give you another credit. You are probably the guy responsible for the popularity of tongue splitting.
Mm-hmm.
You were probably the first one to do it. You hooked me up with a surgeon. You hooked a lot of other people up with a surgeon. You did the, you know, original groundwork. What was how did you actually find that doctor?
I found the doctor. Excuse me. Found the doctor through the Yellow Pages. I basically got myself to the point where, the forked tongue was an image that was in my mind from very young, and just, a bare bones gut feeling. How cool would it be to have a forked tongue sort of feeling? And so I started talking to surgeon, and actually he was the first one that I contacted. I talked with people generally, whether they be, body modification enthusiasts beforehand and stuff, about the possibilities and things. And I just got to the point where I was like, all right, I'm just going to start calling people and, pitching it to them. And I got this surgeon on the line. He was a very nice, open-minded guy, took everything I said very seriously, asked me, questions about why, did the consultation thing over the phone, had me come in and meet him, and he said, it's just another matter of giving someone what they want, and it's not any more dangerous than if they want higher cheekbones or bigger breasts, whatever. If anything, it's, safer than some of those procedures in general. So he was able to go ahead with it. And, to go back to sort of the thing about, being first and those sort of things doesn't really matter to me. This is a cheerily something of getting
and,
what...
And admittedly, there was, I think Dustin did her own at about the same time.
Right.
There's the guy in Italy that did his, year before.
Right. But if you want to talk about, sort of extremeness of rituals, I think that the message that they went through, vastly sort of in terms of an experience overwhelm, mm-hmm. The nice procedure that I got from a surgeon.
Yeah.
But, it was strictly a matter of self-fulfillment. On the other hand, helping other people have it, or get to this,
That's why I'm really giving you the credit, because, you went so far as to, you were letting people you barely knew stay at your place, and you take them to the doctor, and, really helped a lot of people out.
Right, and that to me, I think, is, beyond sort of, that's the old dilemma about charity. Do you do it because are you doing it for the feel-good reward, or are you doing it just to be charitable? That really... I knew what it was like to really want it and to, to finally have it and was so happy with it that, as opposed to saying something like, oh, I want to be the only one or something, I was like, no, I know how great this feels now that I've got it, just to have what I wanted. And it was really, it was a reward for myself to be able to do that to other people. It made me feel good to help other people out.
Let me briefly ask you, what was actually involved in the procedure?
Very simple. Shot of Novocaine into the tongue itself, then the, before the Novocaine, the actual marking. It's very simple, just take the marker and mark down the center of the tongue. And then an argon laser, usually used for a biopsy procedure, there is a procedure that exists to lessen the width of the tongue beforehand. It's very similar to the splitting, it's just that the tongue is left intact, sewed back together.
That's done often for Down syndrome kids.
Down syndrome, yep. And so they just use the laser to work through the tissue. It essentially cauterizes as it goes, and then a number of sutures are placed along the interior of the split to bring the mucosa down over the muscle. And that suturing pattern actually, sort of was an experiment to help make sure we didn't get too much regrowth in the first time. First time with mine, we did get it, but then with the intervening procedures on yourself and then people like Essie, who also had it done multiply done, I went in for a second one, and he had sort of refined the placement of the sutures, and I came at the healing process with a different attitude and a different take and managed to prevent most of the regrowth. And from there, a lot of people have been very successful, with that, just sort of monitoring the healing process and with the new suture pattern.
Yeah, mine actually grew back, probably two-thirds of it grew back.
Right.
Although it was cut quite deep to start with.
Yeah, I think you had like the second one that he did.
That was the second one, yeah.
Yeah, so he hadn't quite gotten, the importance of the sutures towards the back where it comes together.
Like, if I remember right, some of them actually came out at the very back.
Right.
It's interesting, too, when you look at the people who've had their suture and then the people who've done it themselves themselves and not sutured it, it's interesting how differently they heal as well.
Yep.
I think ours are, they're nice and round, and it almost looks like we were born that way. But the ones where they're cut and not sutured, it's this sort of strange flatness to it. And
yeah, it really looks like the cleave down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I noticed that with Alan Faulkner's tongue and my own, we've done a lot of comparison back and forth, And, you know, the method that was done with his is sort of the heated scalpel, almost brand cut.
His method is terrifying. I'm impressed they managed to sit through that.
Yeah. You know, actually, I've seen a couple other things, you know, obviously doing the whole TSD thing, that's some amazing stuff. But actually looking at that and seeing it fresh and, you know, sort of comparing back to the other, you know, once someone has sat through it, I think that that method combined with suturing could provide, you know, pretty good results.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I'm always amazed at what people can do, you know, at home, basically.
Yep.
Anyway, next you went on to tooth filing.
Yep.
Same procedure. You had your tongue splitting surgeon hook you up with him.
Right. Yeah. See, I found that, you know, that having that one, you know, good, you know, in my mind, this is what makes a true professional for the surgeon, a person that, you know, approaches their work with a completely sort of open mind and willingness to, you know, assist the people that you're working on. He became very interested in my project and just the different things I was doing. I mean, he wanted, you know, pictures of my ears, which were stretched, not quite as much as they are now, at the time, and was interested in tattooing, and, you know, he was just very, you know, hungry for knowledge about these sorts of things, about implants and such, and was able to, when I started talking to him about the things that I wanted to have happen with my teeth, you know, I talked about the possibility of removing teeth, replacing them with implants and different things. He directed me to a colleague of his, also right here in the city of Albany, and said that, you know, he can probably help you. He's a cosmetic specialist. You know, he'll be better able to direct you over the methods and options that you can get. So I went and talked to this cosmetic specialist, gave him an idea of the aesthetic goal that I was looking for. After an examination of my teeth, he said, you know, given your teeth and your health and everything like that, and your understanding of what's going on, I think we can do it basically just by doing a filing procedure. There's no need to go to the extent of removing and replacing, mm-hmm. or, you know, sort of build on. And, you know, kind of went over, okay, what will this look like? And ended up, the day that I went over and consulted with him, I ended up saying, okay, when can we do this? And he was like, well, I have a cancellation in a couple hours if you want to come back. And we did it that very afternoon.
Mm-hmm. And what, he just pretty much used a Dremel-type tool and ground them to points?
He used, I'm not overly familiar with the equipment, but basically the dentist drill.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing if he was drilling for a cavity, same machinery. Went through a great number of tips because, you know, we were eating away at so much tissue. It's amazing mm-hmm. how strong the teeth are, and when you're removing that much material just on those four teeth. Took quite a while and went through a number of drill tips to mm-hmm. do it, mm-hmm. but ended up being just fine.
And it hasn't affected the strength of your teeth or anything like that?
Not at all. I mean, one of the things that I do is sort of a sideline. We haven't found a way to sort of work it in as a stage trick, but I can bite through an aluminum can. If you mm-hmm. give me like a Coke can or something like that, I turn it sideways and get my mouth onto it, my teeth will puncture it quite easily and can bite through, and I can pull back and rip a hole in the side of it. I did that in Seattle for Eddie Vedder, and he ended up drinking the Coke out of the can for that. Just sort of an interesting backstage moment.
Mm-hmm. Then later on, you had some forehead implants built for you by Steve Howard yep. from HTC.
Yep. I know Steve has been wonderful to me. He's besides the implants and just being a general sort of, you know, helping me out with other ideas, and we're tossing back and forth some other stuff every time we see each other. He, like you said, did the implants for me, and I'd been thinking about them for a while, and then it was a matter of getting a hold of him and getting in contact. Went down to Philadelphia and went through the implant procedure and did fairly, you know, large initial pieces, five over each eye, to give me the horned ridge I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, you know, he also made the gavage pump that I have for the show, and is just, you know, he's really kind of always been there for a lot of people who want heavier or weirder stuff, and especially for anyone who's ever been part of the circus with Jim. He's always helped out, and he and Jim are from the same town originally.
Mm-hmm. I know Steve doesn't really like people to talk too much about the procedure.
Right.
You know, hopefully we'll be interviewing Steve in maybe a few weeks. But I don't know if your, I had forehead implants as well, and I don't know if your experience was the same as mine, but it's about the most painful thing I've ever done in my life. Not in the procedure itself, but those, you know, those 2 or 3 hours afterwards. I don't know if you had that same.
Exactly. So I often, even during the procedure, once we moved to the second side of my head, and that side actually had a lot more scar tissue just because of, you know, wounds I've suffered to the forehead before, I regularly describe the tail part of the procedure into before I managed to pass out that night as the 5 most excruciating hours of voluntary pain I've ever taken in my life.
Yeah, without a doubt. I don't think people realize that when they see, you know, even little forehead horns are really painful, really, really painful. One of the guys from Infinite had a large implant done in his chest. He had a state of Texas put into his chest, and like an hour later, he had to get on an airplane to fly to Texas. So he experienced this hell, you know, at you know, 20,000 feet.
Yeah.
Anyway, I want to get back to the tattoos. Mm-hmm. Your hands and your face. That's where you really crossed that line. You know, of no going back. What was what was it like that day when you go in and you know, you mark it and you do it and you walk out of there and you know, never ever can you change your mind again.
I think by the time I actually got around to doing it, and I was done with the scale outline initially on one arm one Sunday, and then a week later on the next Sunday, we did the other arm. We went from elbow to fingertips, and at that point it was such a level of anticipation for me because these were the first scales. I mean, since then I've managed to, you know, complete my scale outline. You know, from we've come down the rest of my neck over, down to legs, down to ankles, and onto the tops of my feet now. But these were my first scales that I was going to get, and you know, I went in and we laid them down, and I had been, you know, designing and reshaping and doing the transition from larger to smaller as we got down onto the hand, you know, making the stencils and looking at it, and when I sat down. My tattoo artist Pup, you know, shaved, did the whole cleaning thing, got ready, you know, laid down the stencil and got down to the wrist, and you know, and he looked at me and he said, you know, nobody's saying you won't do it someday, but if you want to not do the hands just yet, you know, you don't have to. And I said, you know, I looked at him and said, no, we're doing it all today. I've been waiting long enough, and went through and he did it. And really, the next couple of days, I was so focused on the healing, just because of, you know, the stories and the general experience of hands having trouble with fading and such, that I just really wanted to make sure that this outline healed well and stuck, and so didn't really think about it. And by the time I was getting ready to think about it, we were doing the other arm, so then I was, you know, in healing mode again. And after that, it was a good couple of months before I got tattooed again, mainly because the school semester had started up and I was still actively doing coursework. And, you know, people commented and such, but it was more kind of jokingly. It was a lot of my friends saying, oh, it looks like you got fishnets on your arms because it just outlined scales. And to a great extent, I didn't get a whole lot of, you know, big public reaction at that point. Once they started getting colored in, then, you know, people had less of a chance to ignore them or not notice them. And they really started standing out. You know, if I was handing money to a teller or something, well, hey, green hand in front of you. And I think that to an extent I sort of experienced what I had predicted. You know, I was working off anecdotal accounts from people like Mike Wilson, you know, passed away a couple of years ago, was the illustrated man in Coney Island.
Mike Wilson's famous from Modern Primitives.
Yeah, that's probably where most people have, you know, experienced him. He talks about, I think, in that Modern Primitives interview, even the sort of through the looking glass effect. And, I mean, I got a little bit of that, and even more so when I, by the time I got around to doing my face, it was, again, almost anticlimactic, because I had had this, you know, when I look at myself in a mirror, even now, where I'm only in outline, I've got, you know, all of this green to fill in still, I look at it, and I almost see it there. So when someone else comments on it, or someone I haven't seen for a while goes, wow, like this, that's the only thing that sort of, you know, wakes me back up and goes, oh yeah, you know, this is pretty pretty huge, pretty extensive. But to a great extent, I find that it's almost freeing, because I can sort of remember back to sort of the high school days, the awkward teenage period where you always go, people are looking at me, and you're always, you get sort of concerned about every little button or something like that. Well, now I know people are looking at me all the time, so I just don't even notice anymore. I just don't care. I'm very, you know, freed up from that experience of wondering whether or not people are staring at me, because I know they are.
That's true. All right, we're going to play some Throbbing Gristle. Mm-hmm. And when we come back, we're going to tell you how you can win Eric's toaster.
Something came over me. Something came over me. Was he white and sticky? Or was he white and sticky? Well, I don't know what it was. No, I don't know what it was. Something came over me. Something came over me. And I don't know what it was. No, I don't know what it was. But I rather like it. Yes, I rather like it. So I'm doing it again. Yes, I'm doing it. I rather like it. So I'm doing it again. Yes, I'm doing it again. Something came over me. Something came over me. Was it white and sticky? Was it white and sticky?
Okay, Eric, you got to tell us all about this great toaster you've got up.
All right. Yeah, a little while ago, I went out and I was thinking about the way that banks and stuff used to offer, you know, get a free toaster with an account or whatever. And I wanted to do some sort of contest, so I went out and I got myself a little Proctor Silex two-slot microchip-controlled toaster. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily your top-of-the-line toaster oven, but it will certainly give you a couple of fine slices of toast, bagel. You got a few nice little accessories. And I decided to offer it up as a prize to anyone who could prove to me that I'm not an artist.
Do you think that's even vaguely possible? I mean, how tightly are you defining artist?
Well, that's the thing. I'm willing to, you know, give anyone a sort of, you know, an open chance. You know, take whatever slant you would like on it, but you've got to convince me to buy into your criteria and such. So, I mean, how good are the odds? Say, if you're, you know, you might have slightly better odds playing a lot of lotteries, frankly. But, you know, even when you don't do it, you don't come away empty. And, I mean, it's slowly getting. I've got a couple of attempts now that I've got to process through. But as it's detailed on my website that if you go through the process of submitting an argument for why I'm not an artist, at the very least, you come away with recognition of the attempt from me in both hard copy and on the website. And, you know, in the event that someone does prove that I'm not an artist, they do get the toaster.
What will you do if they prove this?
Well, there's...
Other than toaster, of course.
Well, you know, other than give them the toaster, and, you know, I'd like to think that I could turn that into a small media circus for at least a little while. I think that I'd be forced to either start striving to meet the criteria that I've then bought into to become an artist, or maybe I'd have to just work harder to refute the argument, though I wouldn't make them give me back the toaster if at a later date I decided I had been successful. Toaster's theirs to keep once they win it.
Okay. Now, you're actually contemplating your thesis around ideas related to this.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly is it going to be about?
Right. Well, I've worked a great deal of a lot of my actual academic work that's, you know, been committed in terms of papers, projects, submissions for publication has been on sort of using linguistic theories to do treatments of questions, sort of, which is very much a Wittgensteinian notion, which is dissolve the question.
I better get you to put it in right. Real simple words, that's both for me and for everyone listening.
His notion was the idea that it's not so much that there's a philosophical problem, like if we say, you know, what is the meaning of life, something like that, is that it's not a real problem. The problem is that we've twisted the language in such a way that we've created what we think is a problem. And if we can just really, if we can understand the terms that are in the question, we get rid of the question completely. My own sort of way of leaning to this and what I want to work on is the question, what is art? Because, you know, historically it's a very, you know, it goes from being very tangential and real and then becomes kind of amorphous, and you've got arguing manifestos back and forth, and you're like, then you end up with institutional theories, you end up with intentional theories, all these things. And I really sort of more and more I come to the opinion as I work on it that you can come up with a definition of art as a term within a language-using community and give it a very, if not a necessary and sufficient conditions definition, you can give it a functional definition. You can say, these are the things that are referred to by the term art in this language by these people. And if you're using art to refer to something else that's not in this category, then you've either got to get the consent of the language-using community or you're misusing the term in that language. And language-using communities, or language games, as Wittgenstein originally described them, can be very, very small or very large and can have little sub-pockets. So I think the part of the problem is just ideas about definitions at this point are, you know, tried to be used too sweeping and too broadly. So if we get down to a more individual, particular case, we can say, look, this is art for these people, for this language, under these conditions. So that we show the argument of whether or not something is art between two people, we can, you know, in a lot of cases probably show that they're just not using the term in the same way.
Well, I think that while you may be able to come up with a subjective term for art, I think you'd be very hard-pressed to come up with one that is universal.
Right.
And if I am thinking of the way American law is sitting, American law has basically decided that it's art because the artist says that it's art.
Right. And I think that, you know, in terms of a legal sense, it's probably the better way to do it. And like I said, it's not so, the goal is not so much to provide a definition of art in that per se manner that we're used to, but rather to show principles via which we can determine whether or not using the word art to describe something is accepted or not accepted in a certain community of language users,
mm-hmm.
such that, you know, if I go up to something, and a lot of it revolves around, too, language use like E-prime, which is a language that has no definite statements. You wouldn't say that is a chair. You would say that seems to me to be a chair.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say to someone, that to me appears to be art, or I think that that is art, it's a much more accurately reflective statement about the state of the world and the mental states of the people in it, you know, even in that self-reflective one, than to say that's art or that is not art.
Well, let me ask you about one of the more famous language experiments, which is probably Logland.
Mm-hmm.
You know about Logland?
The name is in my head.
Okay, the idea is it's a language with the grammatical structures are built such that if you make a statement that's illogical, you've spoken with incorrect grammar.
Okay.
So if you actually understand how to speak the language, you can't make illogical statements using it.
Right.
Or at least that's the idea.
Mm-hmm.
The people into this have, you know, taught their children this, et cetera, in an attempt to actually change their thinking by the language that they speak.
Right. And I mean, that's very, that's at the base of a lot of theories, especially the sort of the ideas that I'm working with the language as well, is that language will bind you into a certain sort of tunnel reality. And, you know, if one doesn't realize this, then you get stuck. I think the classic example of that is scientists spent forever looking for temperature, thinking that, you know, temperature as a noun, the way that it functions grammatically. Their language formed their experiments and their ideas about temperature and heat and different, you know, things that they were working with, until finally somebody stood up and went, look, think of it as a verb instead of a noun, and your problem goes away, to the point where grammar was actually causing huge amounts of problems for physicists. And, I mean, this was just, there wasn't, the actual moment wasn't so much someone saying, look, treat it like a noun as a verb, as it was someone doing an experiment which made them change their definition. But that's, you know, if you look at it from another angle, that's essentially what happened. They stopped looking for a noun and started realizing that it was a verb, a process.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to branch onto something a bit less academic. On your webpage, it says that you're single.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming that's still the case, what are you looking for in a partner?
Pretty much, I'm very sort of open to different partners. I mean, I've discovered at this point in my life, I'm heterosexual. As much as someone may say they're biologically homosexual, I'm heterosexual. That's what it is. So, I mean, in terms of a sexual relationship, I dig chicks. Beyond that, I'm not real specific. There's been fair diversity in my life in terms of sort of physical, mental characteristics. I tend to like people who are in shape and intelligent. And then after that, I think it's just kind of a toss-up. I've been with people that have been everything from completely unmodded and never will to people who have had, you know, fairly extensive tattooing, piercing, heavy stuff and are looking at more to sort of the in-between. Really, it's more a matter of personality compatibility than anything else.
All right, well, on this on the webpage that people are looking at right now, there'll be your email address, and if they want to email you a photo or mm-hmm. description of themselves, I'm sure you won't deny their mail.
I love to get email of any sort, really. I mean, just something to break up the spam every now and then is nice, some real content.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's another thing, like you mentioned, like things with the tongue splitting, because the experiences are out there, I get a lot of emails of that sort, and those are the ones too that I love to sort of, you know, either redirect to somebody who's more qualified or to help out, but I always respond to email of any sort. So.
Mm-hmm. We're going to play some Guided by Voices. This goes out to my friend Sarah, whose computer BME was actually first published on at exactly the same time this song was first played live in 1994.
This song's called I Am a Scientist. I seek to understand me. I am an incurable, and nothing else can set me free. Everything is right. Everything works out right. Everything fades from the side, because that's alright with me.
All right, we're back with Eric. Now we're talking about language before. With your image being pushed so heavily into the sort of visual cultural language of Western culture, what sort of change do you think that you're having? What effect do you think you're having on society? And not just you, but I mean Jim and everybody that's involved in this whole thing.
Right. I think that the main change that's going on is sort of that runs parallel to the fact that I'm starting to get a sort of pop culture image, or you know, getting myself out as an image popularly, is that the extent of people who, you know, see me, and by seeing me see, you know, sort of heavier modifications out there, and because of the context in which they see me is generally one where I have a good deal of control over it, and it's fairly favorable and allows me, you know, to do my normal babbling on stuff to sort of show that I'm not psychotic, I'm not trying to steal their children's souls or anything silly like that. It becomes very, you know, sort of popular. I get a lot of people that I know or have known through the process are like, yeah, my mom and dad asked about you. They saw the piece. They thought it was nice. Now, obviously, they weren't thinking it was nice in terms of, boy, I hope Johnny grows up and does this. But at the same token, they weren't horribly put off. They weren't repulsed. You know, theoretically, they wouldn't mind bumping into me in the street sort of deal. So I think that has a good potential, you know, fallout. I still think that sort of the natural inclination of a parent is always supposed to be, or is always going to be, one of, if their child tries to sort of follow my route, to, you know, be a little bit abhorrent or be a little bit worried or scared. But, I mean, that in the end is probably, you know, a good thing to an extent until the world changes a lot more. My life has sort of been structured. I've lucky coincidences combined with a lot of hard work have made it such that for me, there really isn't much of a downside, much of a hardship level. So it's not something that I think I could say, oh, you want to tattoo your face? Go ahead and tattoo your face. Now, I still, the same way that I do with, say, Sideshow X, oh, you want to learn, you know, how to eat fire, breathe fire, you want to learn to swallow swords, things like that. You preface it with so many warnings and sort of, you know, almost try to drive them off from it. I think the same thing can be said for going into realms of, you know, heavy or extremely public modifications still, that if you don't take it extremely seriously, you're setting yourself up for a bad fall.
Mm-hmm. I talked to when we did Keith Alexander's interview, we talked a little about this. One of my ideas, though, is that if enough people get their faces tattooed and their hands tattooed, that we hit a critical mass and it suddenly becomes okay.
Mm-hmm. I think that what's important too is not just so much the number of people that do it, but the type of people that do it and what they do afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what will make a big step towards, you know, sort of more public acceptance to making it just a completely casual thing, like to the point of, you know, whether or not you're wearing a blue or a blue tie or not wearing a tie or whatever like that, is that people who are either already accepted by society at large have to do it, or you have to sort of work to do it afterwards. I think another reason that I kind of get cut a lot of slack is that people who even meet me or hear about me casually realize that, you know, I'm not a bum. I don't beg for credit. You know, I'm a productive professional.
And I think in every single feature I've ever seen on you, they've made a point of saying that you are, you know, a PhD candidate student.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hook. That's the media hook there.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're totally out of time, so let me ask you if there's anything that you'd if there's one simple thing, you know, that people can learn from what you're trying to say here, what would you break it down to?
I think that the most essential thing would be, hopefully, you know, I can be considered a success in what I'm doing, and that's owed to two things primarily, and that's a knowledge of oneself that allows you to recognize what you really want to do, and a total commitment to then doing it. You know, not knowing well enough will set you off wrong, and not committing yourself fully won't get you there. It takes both of those things together, I think, and you're never, and the other thing is probably like the third of the addendum to that subset would be, this process never ends. Just because you know yourself at one moment doesn't mean you can stop experimenting and sit back. It has to be a constant relearning, retesting process, a boundary-pushing process, and the commitment has to be constantly reaffirmed. You have to keep working just that little bit harder.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, thanks a lot, Eric, for being with us. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll finish off by putting you to sleep with California Lullaby, an old surf cover by Sonic Boom.